Whereas before, the kind of the culture outside Christianity, the secular culture, claimed to be based on reason and science and public truth, there's been a pivot in the last 10 years. That's why we're talking about woke ideology rather than, say, secular humanism. And it's radically anti-reason. It's radically anti-rational. So that rather than arguing that, well, say, male and femaleness aren't relevant to marriage, we're now being told that males and females aren't a real thing, that we just have this gender identity and biology. Sex is just something that the doctors assigned to us at birth. And Richard Dawkins, the biologist, is, what are you people talking about? This is completely insane.
Outstanding is a production of The Washington Stand, where you can find news and commentary from a biblical worldview.
Welcome to Outstanding, where we have critical conversations about the news of the day and the ideas that shape us. I'm your host, Joseph Backholm. In every episode, we try to think biblically about everything. And today, we're going to consider whether there is a biblical way to think about an eclipse. Now, as you probably know, our country was recently caught up in the excitement of an eclipse, which, in the best case scenario, provides about 4 minutes of darkness along the path of totality. But those 4 minutes were preceded by literally years of anticipation, and that fact alone is kind of its own sermon. A few people were surprised to discover that it was not, in fact, an indication of the rapture. But was it an indication of anything? Is an eclipse merely a fun astrological coincidence? Or is it more than that? Is there a reason to think a solar eclipse tells us something about our place in the universe? My guest today thinks so. Dr. Jay Richards is the director of the Richard and Helen DeVos Center for Life, Religion, and Family, and the William E. Simon Senior Research Fellow at the American Principles and Public Policy at the Heritage Foundation. He's also an editor at The Stream, and he joins me now. Jay, thanks for coming on today.
Great to be with you, Joseph. Thanks.
Well, before we get into the conversation, give us a little bit more about your bio and background and how you came to be a guy who's interested in eclipses.
Well, I'm a shameless generalist, I must confess. And so at Heritage, I actually work mainly on the gender ideology fight and am down in that, but have also for a long time been interested in the interconnection between faith and philosophy and faith and natural science. And I wrote a book way back in 2004 with an astronomer named Guillermo Gonzalez. The book's called The Privileged Planet. And the production of perfect solar eclipses are a key figure both in the book and in the argument we develop. And you talked about people knowing for years that this eclipse was going to happen. I'll tell you what eclipse nerds we were. When the book was coming out and we realized it would come out in 2004, we said, hey, there's going to be that total eclipse in 2024. Let's do a 20th anniversary edition of the book. And that's exactly what we did. So there's a lot of really interesting details about eclipses, but very often it's sort of hiding in plain sight and people don't realize it.
Well, you have been tracking these for a long time, and I think actually we met when you were at the Discovery Institute. We were both in Seattle, and you have been tracking these scientific things for a very long time. What was the eclipse experience like for you? Did it meet your expectations after 20 years of anticipation?
I would say it exceeded my expectations. So this is the second total eclipse I've seen. We went to Tennessee for the 2017 eclipse, and I think it was about 2 minutes and 15 seconds there. This one was more intense, in part because Guillermo Gonzalez and I were leading a commentary and an event in Waxahachie, Texas, which is right in the center of the path of totality. And so we had actually encouraged hundreds of people to come to Waxahachie. And then the weathermen all told us that it was going to be murky and cloudy. We were holding out hope, but honestly woke up the morning of. And sure enough, it was murky and cloudy. Didn't know what we were going to do. Just went on down. But about 45 minutes before the totality happened, the skies parted. So it was perfectly clear overhead. 4 minutes and 19 seconds of totality. And so honestly, the fear of not being able to see it and then praying about it and seeing it was just more than I think anyone could have expected.
Well, maybe the break in the weather for everyone in Texas was more evidence of the hand of God. But you, Jay, think that the eclipse itself is more than what it appears to be. Because, you know, we know that the moon kind of in orbit moves between very briefly the sun and the earth. And to us, we know it's a thing that happens. And it's like, I guess it's interesting that it moves on. But is it more than a coincidence? Is it more than interesting? How should we observe these kind of events?
It really is. And explaining why it's interesting and why we think it points to also conspiracy rather than mere coincidence requires a little bit of setup. But the first thing is to note that these two completely different bodies, the sun and the moon, other than being spherical objects in our sky, are really different. And yet they match nearly perfectly in our sky. So that's why we get these total solar eclipses. But they're really more than that, the perfect solar eclipses, in the sense that the bright photosphere of the sun and the moon are able to match both their shape, of course, but also their size and their sky. And so you might think, okay, well, that's cool. So if things are set up so we can see these, maybe that happens everywhere. Well, my co-author in 1999 decided to investigate that. So he looked at what eclipses would look like from all the other planets in the solar system with their 65 major moons, and it's now up to 300 moons, right? So you think, okay, well, maybe this happens a lot. Turns out, no, it happens at exactly one place in the solar system where there are observers to enjoy them. Now, that's cool, again, but I would just say, okay, that's not a design argument. I don't think we've proven God with this yet. It's kind of neat. But then here's the next connection. To build a habitable planet, you got to get a whole lot of things right. So a habitable planet is just a planet where life can exist. One of the key things scientists understand for life in our universe with our periodic table of the elements is you need liquid water. Now, why do you need liquid water? Well, you need liquid water because really the only chemical foundation that you can have for life in the universe is carbon. Carbon's just really well suited for building cells, for storing information, for building complex structures, but it also needs to react chemically, and that's where water comes in. Water is the perfect solvent for carbon. In fact, it's liquid over the same narrow range of temperatures over which carbon chemistry is most reactive. All right, now it's a long setup, but so how's that relevant? Well, so what do you need to have liquid water on the surface of a planet? Well, you need to be the right distance from your host star. In the so-called circumstellar habitable zone, or you can think of it as the Goldilocks zone, this sort of ring around a star. It's not too hot, not too cold, right? Well, of course, it's not a surprise if I tell you that we are in the Goldilocks zone around our star. Okay, so how's that relevant to eclipses? Well, okay, if you're in the right distance from your host star to be able to have life, that's going to set how big your star is in the sky. It's going to appear a particular size, right? We're not going to find ourselves with a star that takes up our entire sky because we couldn't exist, right? Okay, so that's one feature that's part of the eclipse, right? That there's a size of the star. What's another thing that life needs? Life on a planet needs a large, well-placed moon. Turns out that's what we've got too. We've got this large, well-placed moon that stabilizes our tilt on our axis and contributes to the tides. It does a bunch of very important things for life. And when you get that, right, that's going to set the size of your moon in the sky. And when you get those two ingredients that are needed for life on a planet, they produce perfect solar eclipses. And so the conditions for life also provide the best conditions for seeing perfect eclipses. Now, there's one part I'm still missing of the story. Perfect solar eclipses are really, really important for scientific discovery. We were able to confirm Einstein's general theory of relativity because of the bending of starlight around the edge of a star, the sun, during a total solar eclipse. We were able to figure out what stars were made of because of total eclipses. It had been very hard to figure out otherwise, and a bunch of other stuff. That is the element that we think says conspiracy rather than coincidence. It's one thing to say, okay, you got to get a lot of stuff right to get a habitable planet, because the universe is a big place. You can say, okay, well, there's this, you know, trillions of stars. Maybe we just won the cosmic lottery. All right, that, you know, that's a reasonable objection. But what if we were to tell you the same places where life can exist, where observers can exist, find themselves in the best places overall for observing? That's really strange. That's what you'd expect if the universe were designed for discovery. You would not expect that at all if you were a materialist.
But so many people look at this and they say, well, that's a fun story, Jay. I'm more inclined to think that, you know, we are in a vast universe that we only know really a tiny bit about. We're essentially running all these simulations and eventually some version of everything is going to occur. And so you're just making too much of this particular occurrence that we are in. And you're trying to attribute significance to you and to me that, you know, is just part of your ego. But in reality, some version of this had to happen because some version of everything has to happen just because of chance and randomness. What's your objection to that?
Yeah, well, and so that's usually, there's two things. So if we're talking about just this universe, the laws of physics and chemistry are exactly the same everywhere. So everything can't actually happen in this universe. In fact, that's why NASA doesn't spend any time looking for life on the surface of the sun, for instance, right? Or in the middle of space. We look where, what we do is we look in the most Earth-like planet known in the universe, which is called Mars, and it's lifeless, and we're looking for past evidence of liquid water. That's not because scientists at NASA are unimaginative. It's because we understand chemistry really well. We know what the other stars and galaxies are made of, and we know the chemical properties of these things. So any kind of life, if it's going to store information and transmit information and have cells, so chemical life, has to have particular properties. And so all those things are constrained. There's just a lot of stuff that's not going to happen in this universe. Now, somebody could go the second step and say, okay, well, but maybe this is one of just vastly many universes in a vast multi-universe or even an infinite set of universes, right? In which case, everything that can happen will happen. Okay, yeah, I guess you could sort of posit that, but that's, of course, an assertion that isn't especially natural kind of thing that we could do intellectually. Moreover, if we did that intellectually in any other circumstance, right, like a very unusual thing happens. A detective goes into an apartment and there's a woman dead in the in the kitchen with a knife in her back, and the husband had just put out a $10 million life insurance policy on her, and he's fled to Mexico, right? Well, okay, that's sort of telltale signs of intention, right? But you could say, well, but you know, there's this multiverse. And so anything that can happen will happen. And in some universes, you get a quantum fluctuation and ice just appear in people's backs. And so that's also possible. Yeah, it's also possible, but it's a completely idiotic way of reasoning. That's not how we ever reason. And so if you're allowed to take a really strong piece of evidence for purpose or design and then explain it away by multiplying the opportunities for chance to operate, right? When you have no independent evidence that those chance operations are there, you end up destroying your capacity for practical reason. And in philosophy, it's called the Boltzmann brain problem, which is a weird way of putting it. But it's one thing to say, okay, there's lots of other stars and planets in the universe. We do have to take account of those, right, when we're thinking about these things, because we know they're there. But to postulate other universes that we can't see, just to explain evidence of design in this universe, that's not only a kind of a weird ad hoc thing to do, but it also destroys the normal ways in which we reason in the real world.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. I think the right question is, what is the best explanation? We always have limited information, at least we usually have incomplete information. And so we observe something and we say, okay, the life insurance policy and the knife in the back and the husband ran to Mexico. What's the best explanation for that? There are, within the range of the plausible, other potential explanations, but you immediately put these things together and try to come up with the best explanation. And, when you acknowledge the orderliness, and I think that's a good way to kind of describe not just the universe, but certainly our solar system and the ratios of, where the moon is relative to the Earth and where the Earth and the moon are relative to the sun and the conditions that allows. And we can't say, wow, what a coincidence. But, it occurs to me that, I like to hike and run around through mountains. And the mountains are filled with things called cairns, and they are very simple, and they are a small stack of rocks. And, I'm wandering through some pass somewhere and I will see six rocks stuck on top of each other. And in every case, I will look at that stack of rocks and say, someone did that, because six rocks don't just randomly stack themselves on top of each other. Now,
yep.
And because of that, I will assume some intelligence intervened in this environment to create what to me is orderly and not likely to occur naturally. And virtually everyone who observes that stack of rocks makes the same conclusion. And in fact, that is a way that people in the mountains signal trails and make sure we don't get lost and run off and die. Yep. Yet, the same mind that would look at those six rocks and say, yeah, someone is telling me something, can look at a solar eclipse, can look at a universe that is finely tuned in ways that we have not yet gotten into, and say, what an amazing coincidence. How do we reconcile those things, Jay?
Well, I think we reconcile it by realizing that people have a very low threshold for inferring design when it's an ordinary designer within the world. They will often raise the threshold impossibly high if God is implicated. That's what I tend to see. Because, of course, your point about a rock cairn, it might even be just six rocks. That's not like a written text or something, right? It's rocks can kind of pile up, but it really, that's about what it takes. Six rocks by itself, you know, a few feet from other rocks, and you're like, okay, obviously that's a cairn. You know, we know what that is. So it shows you that we're really good at inferring design and separating out the results of design from, you know, physical processes or sort of chance events. But all of a sudden, if it's like, wait, now you're talking about a transcendent intelligence that's responsible for the universe. Yeah, that's troubling. And so it shows you the way in which, on the one hand, we all encounter the evidence of the world. You don't have to be a Christian or believe in God to sort of see things in the world. But you can also, there's sort of metaphysical pressures in the background that move us in one or the other direction. And if you're a committed materialist, you're not going to like the implications of that. Now, look, I'm perfectly willing to say that's true for me as a Christian and a theist. I don't want to bias the evidence in that direction, too. What I ask for is that, look, let's be honest and open to the evidence and not presuppose ahead of time, right, that materialism is true or theism is true. Let's say, like in the case of the evidence we talk about with eclipses and develop in detail on the privileged planet, what you want is to say, okay, the competing hypotheses here would be something like, okay, the idea that the universe is designed for life and discovery, or the idea that the universe is not the result of any purpose. Well, clearly the evidence we're talking about is more likely given the hypothesis that the universe is designed for discovery. That's not a deductive mathematical proof, but that's okay because we very rarely have those kinds of proofs anyway. And honestly, it's only one piece of the evidence, which we could also talk about the fine-tuning of the constants of physics or the information in the DNA molecule or the existence of, you know, transcendent agency and freedom. You know, at some point it's like there's a kind of convergence toward a particular interpretation that I would argue is theistic. And then you add the kind of historical evidences, the resurrection, and you get yourself to Christianity. That's a longer a sort of hike. We don't get that far in the privileged planet. We get as far as, okay, the universe is designed for a purpose.
But as you continue to ask the question, what's the best explanation for what I'm seeing? That's the path that we walk on. Okay, first, we don't see evidence. Nothing in my experience has taught me that order ever comes from chaos without intelligent intervention. I've never seen it happen. Yet, many of us make that assumption when it comes to the beginning of all things. Obviously, this is very ordered. Nobody would argue that life itself is not ordered and does not have rules that are meaningful and intelligent and logical. But we would say all of that logic, order, and intelligence came from chaos, that starting presumption is something we would never apply to anything else we observe in life. Yet, many of us make that assumption. Do you think that's because, and you hinted at this, but I want to ask more directly, are we as humans, and this is kind of your philosopher hat, are we mostly afraid of the implications of the facts than the facts themselves? And is that where we kind of quickly run out of science into a totally different realm?
That is, honestly, it's what I think is happening, because I think if everyone were just sort of neutral on the question, there is far more than sufficient evidence to incline people toward theism. In fact, there's philosophical conundra that are answered really well with theism. I think it's because the idea that it's not just that there could be a creator. Some people they're okay if it's a kind of vague creative force or something like that. I think it is, and I'm attributing motives to people, but I think it's fairly realistic. And people, the philosopher Thomas Nagel has admitted this, that it's not just that he doesn't believe in God, he doesn't want the world to be like that. And some people admit, well, no, if there's a God, he might frankly have an opinion about my lifestyle that I don't really want to listen to. And so, and I had a man one time tell me, he said, yeah, I know you can make a generic argument for design, but I know the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is around the corner. And I do think that that's sort of happening. Now, and that's kind of an ad hominem point, of course. You still have to make good arguments for people, but we have different reasons for either accepting the implications of the argument or not. And that is what I think in many cases is happening. It's just like, I'm engaged in a particular activity that I kind of, in the back of my mind, know God doesn't like it. So I'd really rather prefer not to think about it, unfortunately.
Well, yeah. And that comes back to the old atheist argument that I don't believe in God, I hate him, which is, of yes. course, a logically inconsistent position. But I think it's something that a lot of people take. Jay, I think related to this, mm-hmm. I'd like to get your thoughts on Richard Dawkins' recent statements. Yeah. And for those who don't know Richard Dawkins, he is a famous, well-known atheist and kind of antagonist and arguer against, really an apologist for atheism, for sure. But he has recently claimed to be a cultural Christian, which I found to be fascinating. What are your what's your observations of that?
It really is amazing. And of course, Richard Dawkins is it's sort of the foil and the antagonist to the intelligent design movement. In fact, he uses the word specified complexity to talk about life in one of his books, which is what those of us that argue about intelligent design, we don't just say there's complexity in order, but it's specified. That is, it has a very particular feature. And so he was one of the new atheists, you know, he'd been at it a long time, but he was sort of paired with those guys like Christopher Hitchens and others. He has pivoted intellectually over the last 5 or 10 years. And I'll tell you, it's two things that I think have done it. One is radical Islam. And so he's seeing that not all religions are exactly the same. All religions don't produce the same cultural fruits and the same laws and the same beliefs. They're not just all sort of toxic, which is 10 years ago, he was talking about religion as a mind virus. And of course, your mind virus is something you want to eradicate. He's not talking about that anymore. He realizes, I think, quite acutely that, okay, even though I'm not a Christian and I don't believe in God, I really like the fact that we believe in individual rights and that humans have, there's due process and religious liberty and all these things. And he's smart enough to know where that stuff came from. This didn't come from atheists. This came basically from the Christian patrimony of Europe and the United States. And so now he's seeing that and appreciating that. And here's the second thing is, whereas before the kind of the culture outside Christianity, the secular culture, claim to be based on reason and science and public truth, there's been a pivot in the last 10 years. That's why we're talking about woke ideology rather than, say, secular humanism. And it's radically anti-reason. It's radically anti-rational. So that rather than arguing that, well, say, male and femaleness aren't relevant to marriage, we're now being told that males and females aren't a real thing, that we just have this gender identity and biology. Sex is just something that the doctors assign to us at birth. And Richard Dawkins, the biologist, is, what are you people talking about? This is completely insane. And so I think that's caused him to shift. And he's realizing that, okay, he spent 60 years of his life attacking Christians. And now he gets to deal with the radical queer theorists and the Islamists. And so I think it's giving him a bit of perspective. I think it's frankly quite welcome. I just am glad that I have lived to see the day where I was retweeting Richard Dawkins on X.
Indeed, that is a development, because he has taken a lot of heat recently from former allies on the secular left by denying the idea that men can become women. Because he's, you know, yes. by virtue of his scientific commitments, he has clearly some, you know, conviction that we should care about what is true. Now, I would still argue that he has some philosophy informing and yes. feeding his science, as we all do. But clearly he is not willing to just agree with things because everybody tells him he's supposed to. Jay, a couple minutes left here. Kind of changing the subject, but we're talking about the finely tuned universe and the evidence that the eclipse demonstrates of that and order and thoughtfulness in the way things are laid out. Is there a potential for that set of ingredients to exist in other places? Because we're all wondering, is there life on other planets? And in combining that question with the theological question, is there a theological right. reason to doubt that that exists in your mind?
This is, for me, I treat it as an open question, honestly. C.S. Lewis talked about this, and he said, well, we know that God came to earth to heal us, but in some ways that's like the knowledge of a chicken in one barn in one farm, knowing that the farmer treated him. It doesn't really tell us what else is going on elsewhere, you know. Now, I don't think that from scripture, there's no sense that God created life elsewhere. There are these obscure references to the Nephilim and things like this, but I think that's mostly speculative. Theologically, look, God could create a universe in which life exists in one place or in which life exists in lots of places. It's sort of up to him. And I think we should be open to the evidence. I mean, because we can all imagine a scenario that would persuade us. I mean, if an alien ship shows up in the skies, we'll be persuaded. I think we should treat it as an open question. And I would put it this way. Here's what we're fairly confident of from the evidence we talk about in The Privileged Planet, is that the conditions just for life to exist are exceedingly rare. So the vast majority of places that we can investigate in just our Milky Way galaxy are not going to be compatible with life. We're not just finding Earth-like planets everywhere. It's possible we might find one, you know, that we just can't really say at the moment because we don't have enough of details. But even if you get a habitable planet, it's not as if you get liquid water on the surface of a planet around the right kind of star that life just sort of pops up. It's not a just add water thing. We're talking about the necessary conditions for life. Life itself and its ordered complexity of even the simplest reproducing molecule, it's a different order in kind. And so when you're talking about the sort of habitable planets, all you're really talking about is the necessary conditions for life. And it's possible to get, 12 of the conditions right. And if the 13th thing isn't there, it's still going to be a disaster for life. And so that's why Guillermo Gonzalez and I, we just continue to watch the evidence and look at new discoveries of extrasolar planets. You know, when the book first came out, it were just a couple hundred. Now there are over 5,000 planets that we've discovered around other systems. I mean, we'd always get questions early on, media would call every NASA press release for a new extrasolar planet, supposedly the most Earth-like planet, say, well, what do you think about this? And finally we said, look, call us when we find a planet that's as Earth-like as Mars, then it will get interesting. But I mean, that's the funny thing. That is Mars, that dry planet in our system, yeah. Our neighbor, that's the closest that we have been able to find. And so that tells you how narrow the conditions are. If you've got these two planets, one slightly out farther away from the sun, that's Mars. It's cold and lifeless and dry. Venus is a little inside, a little closer to the sun. It's 900 degrees Fahrenheit, totally hostile. So that shows you that, that it's resting on a razor's edge. And that's true even in a universe that's fine-tuned for the existence of life at the level of the physics of everything. And so for me, I treat it as an open question. God can do what he wants to do, but I do think that if there are any Earth-like planets elsewhere in the galaxy or the universe, they're going to be a major contrast with every other type of planet that we find.
Yeah. Jay, you are often arguing for the truth of scripture and the creation from the perspective of science. Live in a world that is often asserting with great confidence that following the science leads us away from Christianity for sure, but just kind of theology and religion in general. And that's something just the thoughtless kind of Neanderthal rubes who are afraid to confront the world as it actually is do. That's something we turn to as a coping mechanism, right? The opium of the masses, as Marx described it. What's your advice for those of us who are living in that space? How do we kind of engage the world intellectually, scientifically, in a way that's still consistent with what God has revealed to us?
Well, honestly, I think the simplest answer is just make sure you look at the details, because I've not found this, that when you really understand the evidence of science, that suddenly there's a reason to cease being a Christian. In fact, if you just look at the genuine history of science, it's nonsense. I mean, the founders of virtually every subfield of science were either devout Christians or at least conventional Christians who thought that what they were doing was thinking God's thoughts after them. If you think the world is created by a rational God and we're created in his image, you're much more likely to expect that science would be possible than if you're a materialist. And that's exactly what the history of science shows us. It's just that this myth started really in the 19th century that science and faith, and in particular Christianity and science, are somehow in conflict. But that's a made-up story by some 19th century materialists that we really, if you know anything about the history of science, don't be intimidated by that. Now, yeah, do the hard work. Make sure you're not, you know, sort of passing on bogus stuff that you just got on the social media. But go in confidence that the book of nature and the book of scripture, as long as they're rightly interpreted, will be consistent with each other and, in fact, will reinforce each other.
There are conspiracies that have been created from the church, right? But not all of them are because they've come out of theology, right?
Exactly.
So be discerning. Be discerning. Yeah. So, Jay, where can people follow you and your work?
If you want to follow me in real time, it's at X, formerly known as Twitter, at Dr. Jay Richards. And you can follow my articles and stuff like that at the Heritage Foundation at heritage.org.
Dr. Jay Richards, thanks so much for your time today. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Joseph.
And friends, we thank you for listening and joining the conversation. Email me anytime, outstanding@washingtonstand.com, to comment, ask questions, argue with us if you want. Always love to hear that and suggest future topics. We do appreciate that. Make sure you like and subscribe wherever you found us and give us a 5-star review because that helps us reach more people and bring them into the conversation as well. I've enjoyed the time very much. My name is Joseph Backholm, and this has been Outstanding.
Outstanding is a production of The Washington Stand, where you can find news and commentary from a biblical worldview.